Exactly. All kinds of fancy stuff. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun. You've got our buddy Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson, and we're reading through very slowly the book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, from History of Mighty Companions, from our friend Gary Renard. And we're getting there. I'm looking at my Kindle version, and we're moving along. And it's interesting. Other people are reading the book. One of the newer teachers that came in the room just recently is reading this book, and so we were talking about it a little bit the other day. And I was like, "Yeah, I know what you're talking." Yeah, I'm very familiar with this right now. So, so what's up with you, Bruce? What's going on?
More of the same. just keeping busy. I think we're actually narrowing, closing in on having some of the pre-launch stuff ready for the new FIP site. I've been working on it this morning even a little bit. So, and I know what's kind of fun news. Jackie Laura Jones has a new book out that's All Peace, No Pieces, and it's quite good. She sent me a digital copy to review, and it's really excellent. Can't, say enough good things about it. So if anybody happens to be a course student, and I'm assuming there may be a few people in that category listening, I would highly recommend it. Even if you're a newbie or a longtime course student, either way, it's got a lot of good stuff in it. And she really, I think, did a great job of packing a lot into a reasonably, moderate read. It's 160, 70 pages, something like that. Anyway, but it's not a super long book, but each page is full of great stuff. So anyway, I've got a link to it on ACI blog in the sidebar, and there's a cover that shows the jigsaw pieces made out of the book cover of A Course in Miracles coming together to solve the puzzle. So anyway, highly recommend it. Yeah,
I like that. That's very clever.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, I'm pretty much over my bronchitis. So,
oh, good.
That's been a real haul. But I'm working really hard to just keep my respiratory system up and running through the winter. Well, I mean, obviously, so I don't get sick like that again. And so this time I was a lot more proactive going to the doctor. Usually I wait for a couple months until I'm just absolutely miserable and think I'm going to die. But this time I just let it go for a couple weeks, and I said I better go and get this taken care of. And I'm glad I did, because it really did, the meds cleared things up, and so I'm all better now.
Great. Yeah, it's really just another example of the importance of doing what we need to do in the world while we think we're in the world, because we want to be kind to ourselves, and that kindness, in the non-exclusive, fully inclusive thought system of A Course in Miracles would include everyone. And so that, kindness certainly includes the self that we think we are, right?
Exactly.
At least temporarily.
And in fact, it's essential.
Yeah.
Because if I can't be kind to myself, then I'm going to resent you, and any kindness that I give to you is going to be a sacrifice. And so any help, my helpfulness is completely squashed.
Yeah.
So it's really
exactly
for me to be kind to myself, treat myself just as I would any other son of God, which, that's kind of iffish too when you think about it, but you know what I mean.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, not taking care of ourselves impairs our ability to be helpful. It's pretty simple, huh? And it doesn't mean that the form is important. It just means that the intention and the willingness to be kind and to look at the contents of our mind really, more often than not results in the enhanced ability to extend kindness and keep the machinery reflecting in the dream world intact too.
Exactly. And the thing is that is, if we aren't kind to ourselves and we don't take care of ourselves, then we become weak and we become then sick, And then we can only concentrate on ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because when you're that sick, you don't have the energy to go outside of your own body because you're trying to get healed. So it really is the ego. It's a great ego strategy for maintaining control.
Yeah, and even in the early part of the text, it says, you know, to deny our physical experience is a particularly unworthy form of denial. And also, you know, I think Ken Wapnick reiterates it really nicely, is that if we don't use the classroom that is our bodies in this world and all the stuff in it as a way to get back to the unconscious stuff in our mind, then we're, you know, basically denying the means by which we get back to that awareness. And so that's, you know, directly against the curriculum. You know, we're basically, that's just a form of resistance. And that's all forgivable too. But why not, when we catch ourselves resisting, say, ah, hey, I can turn this around. I can let go of that resistance by choosing the right-minded thought system that is kind. Easy enough, huh?
Easy enough
in theory, but it becomes easier and easier in practice as the more we do it, the more we, you know, be mindful and vigilant, gently, to look at the contents of what's all those thoughts flitting through and just say, hey, I can choose peace instead of this.
Exactly. And something, this just made me think of it, because we were talking in my earlier call about how hard it is to switch your mind when you're already down the road on some sort of a rant or you've gotten upset about something. And someone was talking about having an argument or upset with their child and, you know, asking, well, how would I get out of this, you know, thinking once I got into it, you know, how would I get out of it? And I thought, well, with my children, they know, because of, you know, I've talked about this all the time, they know that's not how I want to be. And they know that that's not how, you know, that's not my preference, and then I have a choice. Mm-hmm. And so when I start going down the road on some kind of a rant, my husband or my children will say to me, hey, Mom, what does that have to do with your Course in Miracles? You know, how does that fit with, you know, what you're trying to teach people, and why you tell people all this stuff all day and then you, yourself, go into this thought system? And I'm like, oh my God, now I've got conspirators against me. But but it's true, you know, I've made them the conspirators by giving them that kind of weapon to use, because I don't want to be thinking that way either. And but my ego will tell me, yes, you do. Yes, this is right. Yes, you need to let people know what you think. You need to be in charge. You know, that's not true. It's and so, you know, get conspirators or put things around you that point to you. Oh, you know, you're you know, think change your mind. You know, that's how it works. But anyway, that's why we're doing this.
Yeah, exactly. Because we need the reminders, because the more we share, you know, right-minded ideas, as the Course describes them, the more it strengthens that identification in our mind. And a moment ago, when you were talking about, you know, children, I was thinking, and then, you know, the question that came up in your earlier session, I was thinking, well, you know, the place that we usually go to last is that place in the mind, which is really the decision-making place in the mind, which sees everyone not only as the same, but identical. And that, in truth, not obviously not in form or behavior or anything else, like, you know, that would pertain to our sensory data, but in terms of how the mind interprets that, if we can recognize that we're all in the same boat, we're all fighting the same hard battle, we can all afford to be compassionate, then that, I think, paves the way for us to do something behaviorally as a result of thinking along the lines of, you know, the intention of wanting the best outcome for everyone. And we don't know what that is, but we can hold the intention of having that be what our thoughts and actions, you know, express through us, and then allow our inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, to be the informing, guiding mechanism that then does the speaking through us, whether it's verbally or just mentally, when, you know, we listen to what appear to be attacks and see them as calls for love, whether it's a family member or a politician or a road raging driver or whatever. I mean, it's all the same. Once we get to that place above the battleground of the mind, where we see the sameness, and that sameness then becomes the basis and the justification. Well, it's not even a justification; it's just the obviousness of the importance of forgiveness, because we see that any condemnations keep us imprisoned and separate, and that's the source of our upset, no matter what the upset is.
So. It's right. It's a decision or the choice to make one thing different than another. You know, this is more important. This is better. This is worse. This is sad. This is happy. This is all of the anything that we make that makes a differentiation between one thing and another is going to cause dissatisfaction, because nothing is ever perfect in this world. That we can't accept anything in this world as it is. And that's why when Jesus says in lesson 135, you know, paragraph 18, what could you not accept if you but knew that all things past, present, and to come have been gently planned by one whose only purpose is your good?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a favorite of mine too.
Yeah. You know, once you get that and you recognize, oh, you know, it's all part of the plan for my good. So,
you know, I haven't really made the connection until just now, but as you were reading that, I was thinking that kind of ties into another favorite quote, that, you know, that we would have to be aware of something like an inconceivably wide or vast array of things, past, present, and to come, in order to make, you know, legitimate judgments. And, you know, who except in their wildest, you know, absurd fantasies would, you know, claim that for themselves? And I think that basically not only is very hopeful, because it basically tells us that we don't have to worry about the outcome, because the outcome is already guaranteed. The script is already written and we're already home. But we can expedite, just like putting a FedEx, you know, overnight rush delivery, whatever, on our peace of mind by being vigilant and saying, I'm going to, you know, snag every little grievance, every little thought of victimhood or persecution, whether it's of seemingly self or others, because, you know, the family member is the self, and that family member includes everybody on this planet and beyond. And if we can, you know, catch ourselves doing that, that gives us that vantage point to expedite the process and get home that much quicker. And, so that, and again, that's why Lynn and I do these readings, because it's a great reminder to immerse ourselves in these right-minded ideas and share highly, highly concentrated, cool stuff like Gary's writings.
Exactly. And you know, as you were talking, it was really keying into me today's lesson, because the lesson is all about the past being gone. The source of all fear is gone, and all its thoughts are gone with it. And the only thing that remains is love.
Yep.
The only thing that remains is love in the present state. So,
exactly.
You know, if I'm experiencing anything that is fear or upset or worry or concern or anything, it is because I'm believing in some. I'm believing that, first off, that time is sequential, that one thing happens and then there's another. There's a cause and effect in the world of time and space, and that that because this happened, it means that in the future this other thing will happen. You know, that's the line that I put through here, is that everything is connected through this line of time. But that's not true. Time is an illusion, and everything is happening at this very instant. Mm-hmm. Everything that ever happened is happening at this very instant. It's the only time there is. And so there is no now and then or this, then that. That is not the case in any way at all. Mm-hmm. It is all this and that. So,
yeah, so, even as cool as, you know, some of the recent quantum computing breakthroughs, like these qubits that synchronize their data instantaneously, even if they're galaxies apart, you know, demonstrates that, you know, time is illusory. But I think we need to demonstrate it for ourselves in the way that, you know, by letting go of the linearity and recognizing that, you know, like you say, today's workbook lesson, all fears past because its source is gone, meaning, you know, time's already over and all its thoughts gone with it. Love remains the only present state whose source is here forever and forever. And that's the eternity that we truly reside in beyond space and time. And I think we gradually begin to accept that as we undo our self-condemning identity. Which is, you know, what A Course Calls the Ego. A Course in Miracles calls the ego because that's the insane thought system that says that, you know, somehow, you know, we got left off the roster. Whether or not anyone else did, or not, that is irrelevant. But somehow we think that, you know, the roster of innocence, you know, somehow we did something. Can't even remember it. It's so deeply unconscious. We think that, you know, we threw God under the bus or smashed perfect oneness into a gazillion pieces that are irreconcilable Humpty Dumpty fragments and you know, whatever metaphors you like. But we think we on some level have a justification for this unconscious guilt. But it's only by looking at it and seeing the things that are annoying or irritating or frightening or depressing or, you know, that whole gamut of stuff, you know, jealousies, angers, all those things become triggers to look at, oh, I still must have a self-concept that doesn't include perfect innocence and doesn't include everyone else and everything else in that. And that not letting off the hook is practices keeping me in a hellish state. And of course, Miracles, you know, spells that out in no uncertain terms on pretty much every page, you know. So.
Well, yeah, and so it was really self. I perpetuated my own self mm-hmm. by continuing to look out on a world and judge its contents mm-hmm. and decide that its contents are either helpful or not helpful, good or bad. You know, I'm looking out on the world and making up a story about what it is that I see. And that story is not true. Yeah. It's not just that, but it's that I insist on making it true. I insist on keeping it real. I insist on reminding myself over and over and over, oh, this guy did a bad thing. Oh, this person is sick. Oh, that. I'm reminding myself over and over and over of the fault that I see in the world and therefore in God, basically, for having made such a screwed up world. And so it's not just It's not just, you know, I get over it and it's done. It's that I look at it and decide every moment whether I like it or not, whether I agree or not, whether it's relevant or not. So I'm deciding that moment by moment.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Every single time I have a choice.
Bingo. That's it. You nailed it. I mean, that's it. Because every single moment we can choose what we want to think about ourselves indirectly by choosing what we think about all the seeming others that appear in our world, whether it's a family member or whatever or whoever.
Yeah, and that's why Jesus says to us, you know, why do you ask how could the tiny mad idea have happened? You're doing it now. You're doing it all the time.
Right.
We keep. Yeah, but I have done that.
We keep. nailing up 2x4s on the ground and up to this dead horse that we keep trying to prop up and make it look like it's a real thing. And because our minds are so powerful, you know, we've made a whole universe that looks like it's the real deal and it's a going concern. But it was over long ago. This massive, high production value, polished, you know, flawless hologram that we think is our, facetiously, I guess, call our life, is the real deal. And yet, our true life, as one being shared infinitely, eternally, just smiling gently, you know, and just saying, yeah, you'll get over this.
Yep,
this fantasy, at some point you'll realize this isn't doing it, cutting it for you, and you're going to want to go home, and the home is just waiting there for you patiently. So.
Yep, and in fact, you've never left.
Exactly.
And you come to understand, oh, I'm still here sleeping in my in my bed. I never left home.
Reliving the silly dream.
Yep. Oz is in my mind. Well, let us read, and we left off when we're talking about death.
Uh-huh.
And so Gary was thinking about, you know, death being painful and terrible, and Art and the person are telling him, no, that's not true. So I'm just going to read the last part of this one paragraph and then move on.
Okay.
He says, my father was on the job and he just fell dead, his body going to the ground. When I heard the news from the doctor on the phone, it was like a nightmare. My poor father, I thought. I figured it must have been very painful and horrible for him. But thinking about it now, I realized, first of all, that he passed away quickly. Second, he probably wasn't feeling any pain from the instant he passed away. The pain probably ceased immediately, right? When you're no longer in the body. And Artin says that's correct. So there you were, devastated and crying, and here he was having a good time. You know, and this just makes me think of, I don't know if you're a sports fan, but we tend to record the football game and watch it later so we can go through the commercials and stuff. So even though I know, because people on Facebook said, oh, the Broncos won or the Broncos lost or whatever, until I watch the game, you know, I'm still watching the game with the hope that they will win. You know, even if I know they lost, mm-hmm. I'm watching a video of a game thinking, oh, they might win. Even though I know the outcome. It's mm-hmm. like watching a movie and expecting that the character in the movie is going to do something different than they did the last time when they caused a disaster. I'm looking at something that's over.
So you mean the next time we watch Wizard of Oz, the Wicked Witch will again put you know, sleeping magic on the poppies, and Dorothy and her friends will again fall asleep, and the script is written. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but I still am hoping that it isn't. So when it's over, it's over, and it doesn't come back. It doesn't reoccur. So Artin says you're devastated and crying, and there he was out of it. He was having a good time. And he says, I assure you that when both of your parents made their transition from the incident happened, it was a wonderful experience for them. And that's true no matter how horrible a death a person may appear to go through. Say somebody gets shot in the head. Anybody who sees it or hears about it, especially those closest to the person, is horrified, especially if they're standing next to the person. But that doesn't say that. But what they don't understand is that the person goes immediately into an experience that is fantastic. As the Song of Prayer section of the Course says, we call it death, but it is liberty. And Persa says, it was the same with your mom. Yes, she did suffer before she made her transition. The doctor shouldn't have operated on her. Her blood pressure was too low, and he botched the operation anyway. Afterward, while in intensive care, she suffered a heart attack, and the whole thing was a disaster. You were in agony over it. But most of your crying was after she appeared to die. And you know what? For her, that was the best part. Once the body appears to stop and the mind keeps right on going, it's one of the better experiences an ego mind can have. So while you're grieving all through the funeral and after, the loved one who has passed away is having such a fun time that you'd be jealous if you knew how much fun it was. However, yeah, I'm crying and you're having a good time. That's not right. Okay. However, after you go through all the mind adventures that people talk about in the near-death experience, which do appear to happen for most people, and this is what Artin was talking about when he said, your experience of death will be different, depending on how much guilt in your mind has been healed. There comes a time when you're going to the light. Now, let's say you were enlightened in that lifetime. If you were, you wouldn't go through all the stages people talk about in the near-death show. If you're enlightened, gently lay the body aside for the final time.
I apologize for the giggling. The near-death show. I just step right up. Get your tickets for the one and all day. Jumping through flaming hoops. And
tonight only.
Really. A near-death show nearest you. Yeah.
But if you're enlightened, you gently lay the body aside for the final time, as the Course would say, and you're at home in God immediately. Of course, you always were, but we're talking about your awareness. In fact, the instant you become enlightened, while you are still in a body, which is where enlightenment occurs, not during the in-between life, you become aware of the fact that you are one with God, always were and always will be, and you experience it from that moment on. Then when you lay the body aside, your experience of your perfect oneness with God continues for eternity, which has no time. So basically what they're talking about is a concept that is die before you die. You know, when you come to the moment, the experience that you are one with everything and have no, not like the hot dog, that you have.
Hot dog vendor, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you know that there is no separation and no distance and no difference, and that then you become in perfect peace, and so you are already past beyond the body, beyond the world, and Jesus does extol us to do that throughout the Course. He tells us, get over this so that you can be in this place of perfect peace, so that you are no longer being pulled around by the tides of the earth, so that you can actually be of help and service to your fellow brothers. And, you know, here's the way to do it. Do what this Course tells you to do and get on with it, because, he needs us to be awake and aware. Yeah. And not to be sleeping and dreaming of death.
He's recruiting lighthouses.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking, when you talk about the tides, I was thinking, well, you know, I've always been drawn to the metaphors of what doesn't change, and that's probably why I got into, you know, what's become known as sacred geometry, and my geometry code website has all kinds of stuff about that, because, you know, the laws of geometry are pretty much true no matter what time you study them, you know, whether it's 1,000 years ago and in the time of Plato and Archimedes and so forth, or Egyptians prior to that, you know, making the Great Pyramid, or whatever. And it's also true of where, no matter where you are in the cosmos. But then, you know, there's still exceptions to things, you know, like hyperbolic spaces and things like that, you know, where you have to kind of keep revising. It's been this quest of, well, what doesn't ever change? And I think that's really what it inevitably led me to A Course in Miracles, because it's really that pure non-duality, which is what Gary writes about so eloquently as well, that I think is what we all really want. And even if we can't articulate it that way, but that's ultimately what we're – the only thing that's ever going to satisfy it is that complete, perfect oneness with God that continues for eternity, which has no time, because we're timeless and we're spaceless. And that's why letting go of a body sometimes, even in the morning, sometimes just as I'm waking up, I don't know if anybody else has noticed this, that you kind of notice, oh, I'm back in my body kind of thing. If you ever have that experience and you realize, wait, and it's almost like you, it's not like you, you know, land it with a thud necessarily. It's just you kind of suddenly feel the weight of your body and you realize, oh, well, there's another awareness that isn't so fixated on the body that is much more free. And so I think we're kind of, you know, giving ourselves a little training by doing this forgiveness classroom where we begin to recognize the contrast between identifying with a body and not identifying with it. And that way, you know, when the time comes ultimately to let go of the bodily identification altogether, you know, we've kind of strengthened our mental muscles to become aware of the idea that you know, that's not our real identity, and it's a burden. I mean, you know, we do our best with it and take care of it, and it just, you know, like feeding a pet kind of thing. You know, it's you know, it merits taking care of, but not making a big deal about, right?
Exactly, and I have had that experience, and I bet a lot of other people have, mm-hmm. of moving in and out of the body and feeling like when I'm waking up that I'm moving into the body. So that's a good analogy. So you want to read?
Sure. I was just going to suggest that. So Gary says, I want it, meaning the perfect oneness with God that continues for all eternity, which has no time. So Gary says, I want it. And I know the answer to the following question, but I'd like to hear it from you. What happens if you're not enlightened? Persa, we've said that all pain is caused by guilt. That includes psychological pain as well as physical pain. But even if you're not enlightened, if there has been real healing, which by definition there would have been if you were practicing forgiveness, then the in-between life will be a much better time for you than it would have been if there wasn't real healing. With healing, the Course says this about your experience of death, in quotes, now we go in peace to freer air and gentler climate, where it is not hard to see the gifts we gave were saved for us, unquote. And then that kind of ties into that part early in the text. I've saved every loving thought and every kindness and purified them of their errors and, you know, that kind of thing. It's really, you know, a helpful reminder that, you know, that the things that we have learned and demonstrated that reflect that awareness of our oneness in this world are saved for us. And all the kind thoughts we have about all the other people in our world and animals and pets and forests and oceans and, you know, everything that looks gently on our projected world then becomes a healed part of our mind that we, you know, take with us. And I think what was challenging for us is I think we still, you know, are so fixated on the specifics, we think that the specifics are what is giving us the peace or the pleasure or the comfort or whatever. And we, you know, confuse all these, you know, things having to do with form, and try to ascribe cause to things that never had cause. And once we stop doing that, it becomes much easier because then realize, well, the cause is in the mind all along, and it doesn't depend or isn't contingent upon any specific. And that's very freeing, isn't it?
Absolutely, it is. And we can do that. I mean, it's something that's done.
That's what this curriculum is all about, isn't it? That's what A Course in Miracles is aiming to do, is to you know, help us remove the barriers in our mind that we've placed in obscuring the awareness of perfect oneness and innocence that we all have. And sure. So let's see. Let me finish this paragraph. So even if you're going to review one more lifetime, if you've been practicing forgiveness, your experience of death is going to be a good one. If people don't practice forgiveness, it's not a sin, but there will be still a lot of unconscious guilt in their mind. Then when they're going to the light, which is symbolic of God, the guilt, pain and fear starts to come to the surface. They start to feel the psychological pain and they want to escape from it. They want to hide, and the place they hide from it is here, the projection of a world and universe. It's a reenactment of the separation from God. The dream world is a hiding place where that fear and guilt is projected outside of them. Now it looks like they've escaped because the cause and blame appear to be out there in somebody else. But it's a faulty mechanism because they haven't escaped. The guilt is still there in their mind. Despite the ego's illusion of projection, the Course says, quote, ideas leave not their source. and their effects but seem to be apart from them, unquote. That's the bad news. The guilt and fear is still there in your unconscious. The good news is this. Because ideas leave not their source, you haven't really left God either. Yet for those who believe in the separation and have not yet accepted the truth, the world becomes their home once again. Jay says, quote, guilt asks not for punishment, and its request is granted. Guilt asks for punishment, and its request is granted. Not in truth, but in the world of shadows and illusions built on sin, unquote. And then Gary says, so if I achieve enlightenment this time around, which you say is possible, I won't go through all the near-death stuff again. I'll be experiencing my perfect oneness with God while I still appear to be here, and I'll barely be aware of my body. My awareness will be with my reality. Then, when I lay the body aside, that's it. I'm home. So what about the thing in the course about God taking the final step? It says here, I'll read it, and there's a long quote, a couple of paragraphs worth, forgiveness is unknown in heaven, where the need for it would be inconceivable. However, in this world, forgiveness is a necessary correction for all the mistakes that we've made. To offer forgiveness is the only way for us to have it, for it reflects the law of heaven that giving and receiving are the same. Heaven is the natural state of all the sons of God as he created them. Such is their reality forever. It has not changed because it has been forgotten. Forgiveness is the means by which we will remember. Through forgiveness, the thinking of the world is reversed. The forgiven world becomes the gate of heaven, because by its mercy we can at last forgive ourselves. Holding no one prisoner to guilt, we become free. Acknowledging Christ in all our brothers, we recognize his presence in ourselves. Forgetting all our misperceptions, and with nothing from the past to hold us back, we can remember God. Beyond this, learning cannot go. When we are ready, God himself will take the final step in our return to him. And Gary says, that's a pretty good summary of the course, actually, and it's in the preface. I remember the first time I read that, though, when it said God himself would take the final step in our return to him, I thought that meant he was going to kill me. Arden says, no. Remember, God created you. You didn't create him. That's why he takes the final step, which, of course, is metaphor. You simply pick up where you left off, not that you ever really left, with him as creator, and you, with capital C, and you as creator, with a lowercase c. As the Course puts it, not one note in heaven's song was missed. But God will always be your creator. Then you create the same as him. The infinite extension of perfect love is not something the finite mind can understand, but the time will come when you finally get to actually experience it. Do you want to go on from there?
Sure, I'll continue reading. I mean, this is pretty heavy stuff, but
yeah.
To really come to a place where you can even intellectually understand and believe this is a pretty amazing thing. And I'm really excited that they're talking about things from the Song of Prayer and the psychotherapy section, because those are, even though they're well known amongst Course students, until this most recent edition of the Course, it wasn't really part of the actual book itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I was able to get one of these combined editions with all the Song of Prayer and everything in it. And it's so amazing, the elevated concept that comes about when you read the thoughts about death, because I hadn't thought about that at all. I just thought when you died, you still were in the same misery that you had been in before, and you just went looking for another lifetime scenario to express it in. And it never occurred to me that there was any kind of peace after death if you weren't at peace before death. But it also is interesting to me the idea that if you overcome the world through practicing forgiveness, that that you already passed through that, and death has, as the body, it has no meaning to you. The body is meaningless too. So
if this world is nothing, and as the Course puts it, then how could a change in nothing affect us? I mean, what, you know, if the body appears to no longer be where we house our identity, and we become aware of that, then that's the only thing that's changed. And and so there's no instant promotions or demotions, especially if the status that we all share eternally is perfect innocence, then there's nothing to demote or promote.
Or promote.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to continue reading. So Persa says, when it comes to the part of the preface you just read, it reminds me of something we want to make sure people are absolutely clear about. From beginning to end, in all 31 chapters of the text, the workbook, the manual for teachers, the clarification of terms, the psychotherapy section, the song of prayer, everything Helen channeled from 1965 through 1977, the Course is totally consistent and uncompromising. There have been some teachers who think they have found the right interpretation of the Course, meaning their interpretation. No. The truth is there is only one possible interpretation of A Course in Miracles. That is the truth. I have no doubt about this. The truth is there is only one possible interpretation of A Course in Miracles. We've been giving it to you since we first started appearing to you 25 years ago. You've also heard it from the Wapnick School. I like that, the Wapnick School. We haven't wavered, and we're glad to see that you haven't either. Gary, yeah, but you never stop some people from nitpicking the Course to death. I've had people tell me that you can't trust the Course because they've edited out the word souls in the first five chapters, and that word implies individuality and God creating it. And yeah, so there's, you know, a lot of, you know me, I'm all about the controversy about, you know, changing the Course. And, you know, I think it's ludicrous to think that every note that Helen ever wrote down was something sacred. And even Helen didn't believe that from the actual words that Jesus told her. Yeah. She didn't think they were sacred words. She just thought
it's the
words.
Content that's sacred. And that's the one, the reflection of the truth that you know, is immutable. and but we all are that and have that. So, and you know, the book, by the way, which you can get, the if anybody doesn't have the version with the Song of Prayer and the Psychotherapy pamphlet in it, you can get that online, of course, at the Foundation for Inner Peace website, which is acim.org. But the point here is that, you know, we all have that always, and so, you know, fussing over the form is exactly the thing that we're asked to let go of gently and just say, hey, it's the content of the mind that is really where the change needs to happen, and we all have that capacity. We all have that locus of control, decision-making faculty that chooses between one of two thought systems, and that's what this whole curriculum is aimed at, isn't it?
Exactly. And so however we get there, it's the goal. It's not the path. It's not the words or the steps or anything that we take to get there. You know, it's the actual doing what Jesus tells us to do. So, you know, you could even ask yourself or anybody else who's going through these things and quibbling, what is the purpose?
Yeah.
So what's the purpose of the quibble here? What's
exactly
the purpose of this discussion?
One thing I'll mention, and this is, and I don't think this is a spoiler alert or anything like that, but the new version of the FIP website, which I've been working on diligently for quite a while, and we're getting much, much closer to launching it, hopefully in the next month or so. Anyway, that new version is going to have an extensive frequently asked questions page, which I've just finished re-editing quite a few times. But anyway, I think this version is finally the one that's going to stick for a while, and it's got some great content in it. So when the new site finally does launch, I strongly encourage people to, you know, make a direct direct march to the FAQ page and read it in its entirety. And it's got a lot of great stuff in it that you know, I think a lot of people will be familiar with some of it, but there was a lot of things in there that I didn't know and that I found really helpful, not only just from a historical perspective, but from, you know, the perspective of a student of A Course in Miracles that are just kind of, you know, when you think about it, common sense things, but they really are spelled out very nicely. And kudos to Bob and Emmanuel Rosenthal and all the other folks at FIP that contributed to it, because I think they did a fabulous job putting a lot of really important content in the FAQ page. So, which is, you know, admittedly a longish read, but well worth it. So, you know, look forward to that.
Anyway. That's amazing. Now, is it the same FAQs that you were going through before that we were?
No. This is Foundation for Inner Peace website, not the Foundation for A Course in Miracles.
Okay.
Yeah. Which cool. Also, by the way, the FACIM.org website did recently launch this past year. It's been better part of a year now. And if you haven't seen that, it's wonderful. They have a new glossary that's fabulous. It's all crossed, hyperlinked, and just brilliant. And kudos to David Saleur and his other web partner, whose name escapes him at the moment, but all the folks there who've done a fabulous job renovating that website. But in particular, I would encourage people to look at the new glossary on that, and they just did a beautiful job, you know, in every respect with that new website that they're working on too. So kudos to them.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to it then.
Yeah. So anyway, the two, just in quick summary, if you're looking for online resources, you, as a course student, I strongly encourage every student of the course to familiarize themselves with FACIM.org, and all the wonderful resources there. And some of them are now only in book form, and like the FAQs and the Lighthouse articles. But they're trying to, you know, kind of keep the thing going in terms of their revenue. So I also strongly encourage people to support FACIM, Foundation for A Course in Miracles, is still being continued with Gloria Wapnick at the helm, and they're doing a tremendous job of continuing to polish and refine some of Ken's work that, you know, is either underappreciated or not even put out there, and then they're still adding new content because his prolific and prodigious output is still being, you know, put together and distributed and disseminated. So anyway, and the same is true, just as a quick aside, with the FIP site. This new website that we've been working on, quite a few of us now, for a number of years, is just about ready. But once that's done, we're not going to be sitting on our laurels, and there is an enormous amount of wonderful content. I was privileged to go to visit Judy Sketch Whitson in Marin County in August a few months ago. And she sat down with a few of us, and we looked at this huge backlog of wonderfully annotated set of, you know, a collection of videos, audios, photos, and stories that have the context of what these all mean. And it's just fabulous. So I think it's going to take a while to get that process rolling and to keep all the wonderful, I mean, the prolific content that she's put together. You know, she and Ken both have been fabulous, but her efforts, I think, will be appreciated over time when people begin to see how much wonderful historical material that also ties into the contents of the course as well. So much backstory that people have no idea about that's really wonderful that is going to become available through the FIP website, which is acim.org. So to wrap up this aside, you know, keep your eyes on, you know, go ahead and visit FACIM.org and keep your eyes peeled in the next, hopefully, few weeks for the new ACIM.org website. So, anyway.
Very good. Thank you
for allowing me that digression.
Yeah, I love it. If people are just apparently starving for more information, because, as you know, Circle of Atonement put out a volume where they analyzed everything ad nauseum. And there are a lot of people who are just lapping that up. And, I got Dove bought me one, sent me one, and, you know, I looked through it. I don't see any improvement in any way at all from the Course in Miracles. I don't see any, I mean, it's got interesting stories in it. But there are stories that are someone else's idea of what happened. You know, there are stories that somebody read or heard what happened, and then they wrote down what they thought they heard or read. And so it's just another person's opinion about what went on or what, you know, how things came to be. And so I'd really like to hear from someone who has been intimate with the entire process from the very beginning. I think I'd be interested to hear what they have to say.
I don't want to belabor this too much, but what I don't think Judy would mind me sharing this, but what she was sharing with us in August when I was there visiting was that not only does she have an enormous amount of archival material that she's been diligently and beautifully and brilliantly putting together and in the context that will help people appreciate the depth and breadth of the Course and its historical precedents. But she also says, Ken never really was into the archiving thing. You know, so Ken basically asked Judy if she would, you know, take charge of handling all of his archive stuff, which she did. And of course, she also has Bill and Helen's archive stuff. So she has apparently, you know, multiple storage units of archive material. So I don't think we're going to run short of this for a while. Wow. it's just going to be how do we get this out there? So anyway, if anybody happens to know Judy, hopefully she won't mind this suggestion. But you know, I'm not making a special pilgrimage or anything, but if you happen to be in contact with her and if the conversation comes up, just say, hey, we're really looking forward to, you know, that archive material, because I know she's worked so hard on it and done such a great job. Anyway, I'm looking forward to seeing what's there, and I'm sure any serious Course student will be, you know, eagerly and enthusiastically thrilled to see what that process evolves into over time. So, which is early stages of planning how to do that. So anyway,
exactly. Well, yeah. And so whatever it is will be helpful at the time.
Yeah.
And that's, exactly. You know, that's the thing. These things are written in a script that, believe it or not, was written long ago and the end is certain. So, So let's just enjoy ourselves while we're here, I guess.
Yeah. Final thought is that, you know, the few times that I've been able to visit with Judy have just been such a delight, and she in my mind is another example of someone who really lives the Course and practices it, and shares in a wonderful way the feeling of welcome and hospitality, and you know, the grace and generosity of spirit is so evident in her presence, and just can't say enough good things about her not as a person, but as a decision making mind who has embodied and really, I mean, that living basically is a better word, you know, of the Course, and a real inspiration. So thank you, Judy, and everyone at FIP has just been a delight to work with us. I've been, you know, consulting with them for about 3 years now, so it's been a great fun, and I've learned a tremendous amount on so many different levels, and my gratitude is very full. So thank you.
Yeah, you know what, you are a very fortunate human being.
I really am. I consider myself completely so. Yes.
So blessed. Yeah. So blessed. It's amazing. So, you know, we're actually, you know, it sounds kind of crazy, but it is like we are pioneers here, and you know, that we're bringing forth the birth of a new nation or a new world. And it's coming from the very work that you and I are doing, you know, as insignificant as it may seem at the time, you know, really is, you know, bringing about the awakening of this Holy Son of God from the dream.
Yeah. And certainly from you know, lots of different perspectives, that seems very true. And not or, but and, it's also true that what we're, you know, recovering or rediscovering has been in our awareness all along. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Dorothy realizing, wow, I could have clicked those ruby slippers together any old time. but yeah, it's nice to be able to be the Glindas, I guess, and point out that we have that ability all along, kind of thing. So, and of course, we're reminding ourselves of that as we share it. So that's the fun of it, isn't it?
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's why you and I get together every Saturday morning and do this. And it looks like we're really running kind of close.
Oh, we are, aren't we? Yes.
Our time. Let me just read this last little section. Uh-huh. We've got a couple minutes. And then it'll put us in a place where we can start again next week. So Gary's been talking about the changing of the word souls to spirit, and of course we know Jesus told them to do that in the clarification of terms. Mm-hmm. But Artin says it's certainly true that some people can't be stopped, but the word souls was used temporarily early in the course for Helen's sake, when she was getting used to channeling again. As you know, she worked with Jay in other lifetimes. The word was meant to be a metaphor referring to the seemingly split-off minds of the sonship. Those split-off parts, or souls, are illusory, and that's how the word was used. Soon after, when Helen had cleared out the cobwebs, that word wasn't used anymore, which is why Jay instructed her to take it out. Why confuse people? They're good enough at doing that themselves. It was as was eventually proven.
We're also talented in that, aren't we?
Yeah, very talented at that. The word sonship and the description sons of God were soon used instead, but whenever the Course refers to sons of God or anything plural like that, those who have yet to change their minds, that's metaphor. It's clear that the Course is saying that in reality there is only God's one Son, which is Christ, perfect oneness, and the same as God. But the ego will do anything to cling to the idea of her individuality and separation. Yep. And so I think, I think that's probably a good place to end.
It does seem like a good place, yeah.
Because then next week we can talk about this idea of separation, uh-huh, and individuality, and how unnecessary it is.
Totally unnecessary.
Yeah, the sparkly uses it a lot, Carrie is saying. And yes, and that's because the person who put the sparkly together decided he didn't like Jesus telling us not to use the word souls, and he liked the word souls, so he put it in there. So that's, you know, we're free to do what we want in this world, and we can make it anything we want. Jim Dunn says, tell me again, what's a metaphor?
That's right. I never metaphor I didn't like.
That's right. All right. So, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. Please
likewise.
Join us next week, everyone. The House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And, we're still plowing through the book. But right now I'm going to let go of the mic and turn it over to Iris and Carrie. And thanks again, Bruce Rawls.
Likewise, Lynn. Have a great week, all.
You too. Bye-bye.